The following is an encore episode of Hour 1 of the Turley Frequency with host Kevin Turley. We hope you enjoy.
You've tuned to the Turley Frequency, starring your host, Kevin Turley, with guest stars Mike Romano and Reed Hodges, and special guest stars, the members of the FCC, whom we respect respectfully. Now, time to get tuned into The Frequency. Call the show at 888-928-0881. That's 888-928-0881. Or text us at 251-928-2111. And now we cross live to the Archangel Radio Studios in downtown Fairhope to at last feel the Turley Frequency.
Hello and welcome to this edition of the Turley Frequency. I'm your host, Kevin Turley. For the next 2 hours, I hope I will be entertaining and edifying in equal measure. Today on the show, we meet Dr. Paul Kengor, who is an academic and an author whose latest book deals with the controversial subject of slavery and the Catholic Church. So we're going to speak with Dr. Paul Kengor in the next segment. After that, at the top of the hour, we're going to pray the Divine Mercy Chaplet. And guess what? You're invited to join us. Feel free to text me your prayer requests on 251-928-2111. The lines are open for you right now. Finally today, we welcome back Dr. Marcus Drayman to discuss all things marine, and in particular sharks. Yes, sharks off the coast of Alabama, and what happened at the weekend in the deep sea fishing rodeo. Okay, with all that good stuff, let's get this show on the road. Hello and welcome to this Tuesday's edition of the, what is it again, the Turley Frequency. Yeah, actually, I had to think about what day it is because all of these days seem to roll into one at this time of year. I don't know how you're experiencing this summer, but every single day our weather is exactly the same over here. It's overcast, gets a bit sunny, our hopes get up, and then the rain starts and the rest, you know. And my garden is still growing at a rate of knots. It's more like an episode of the Day of the Triffids out there. I'm hoping to get out this evening to do some cutting back of the various weeds, which my wife has helpfully pointed out to me. Okay, so this is a Tuesday in the month of July, in the month dedicated to the precious blood. So I have a question for you this morning. Yeah. I'd love you to call in and give me an answer. 888-928-0881, or even just text me 251-928-2111. And the question is this: is it a coincidence that the movie Sound of Freedom is doing so well in this month of July? Now, as you just heard, this is a month dedicated to the precious blood. And if you stick around to the end of this monologue, I will give my idea of why this perhaps is no coincidence. I'll come back to all of that in a moment. Now, I wasn't going to talk about Sound of Freedom today. We talked a lot about it yesterday, and we were hoping to have people on from Angel Studios. No doubt we'll have them on at some point. So I thought, well, we've kind of done that, right? We've done Sound of Freedom. Let's move on. But I was really surprised at the number of news items that are popping up about Sound of Freedom and the type of news items that are popping up about Sound of Freedom. Now, at the weekend, we talked about this yesterday, there were two major releases. Do you remember? There was Barbie, a movie about a plastic doll brought to life, but still very plastic. And also Oppenheimer, a film which should have bombed, but it's all about a bomb, an atom bomb. Both did very well by all accounts. 1 and 2 in the box office list. Sound of Freedom still hanging in there at 3. Incredible, right? We talked about that yesterday. This is incredible that a small independent movie is doing so well against these major movies promoted by major studios. We did that yesterday, right? But here's the thing. All the reports on Monday morning in the British press, because we had the same films over here, were celebrating how wonderful the box office receipts were at the weekend. Many were saying that it was cinema's best box office weekend for years. For years. That the release of Barbie and Oppenheimer, suddenly the cash tills were flowing. People were flocking to the cinemas, movie theaters, both in the United States and in Europe. And this was great news. This was something to be celebrated. Now, as I pointed out yesterday, Sound of Freedom, from a small base, has grown and grown and grown. It is one of the few films that into its third week of release, they're expanding the number of movie theaters that it's been screened at. This is unheard of, right? Most movies go the other way, for obvious reasons. So you think Sound of Freedom would be part of the celebration, right? Part of an industry which has taken a number of knocks over the years and it is in the middle of a strike, both writers and actors and all the rest of it. You think that this would be a good news story about how a small independent movie that cost roughly $15 million has made almost 10 times that at the box office and is looking even better in the coming weeks. You think that would be part of the celebratory message that the media would be singing at this time? No. Quite the opposite. Now, a film like Sound of Freedom, like most small independent films, they struggle for publicity, right? All movies struggle for publicity, unless you're the Barbies and the Oppenheimers, which have hundreds of millions of dollars behind you just for the publicity. So the worst that can happen to a film like Sound of Freedom is that it gets ignored. People just forget about it. But that also hasn't happened with Sound of Freedom. So they're not celebrating it as a plucky underdog coming through. They're not just ignoring it, thinking, yeah, whatever. The real surprise is that there seems to be a concerted effort, dare I say almost a coordinated campaign, to denigrate the movie, its actors, production team, and even the true story upon which it is based. Now, I'd seen bits and pieces about this in the various media in the last days, and I thought it was maybe one story. I think there was a story initially in Rolling Stone, which was very, very negative, linking the movie to all sorts of conspiracy theories. I'm not going to justify them or dignify them with any comment, but it was something which you would kind of expect in something which is, okay, it's mainstream media, but it's a bit out there, Rolling Stone. Not a bit of it. I was really shocked by some of the comments that I was coming across in the mainstream media. There was one I was going to play to you today. I'm glad I'm not playing it for you this morning because I had to sit through it. And the more I was listening to it, I couldn't believe my ears. He was on MSN, CBS. He was a commentator. He had a British accent, but he's an American show. I'm not going to identify him. I didn't know who he was, to be honest, when I first turned it on. But very quickly, he went from talking about the movie to talking about Jim Caviezel, its star. And I was quite shocked at what he said. He made sure there was a reference to Jim Caviezel's amazing performance as our Lord in The Passion of the Christ. It was a rather sneering reference. But the whole piece was a sneer. It was a sneer at the actor, the team behind it. But here's the thing. Also, the audience. Americans like you who paid good money to go and watch Sound of Freedom. You were all part of some grand conspiracy. You were all quote-unquote fruitcakes. Or words to that effect. I can't remember the exact word. But it was along that lines. It was sneering. It was awful. I'm not going to play you any of it because it's just insulting. Just as an aside, I wondered, who is this guy, right? Who is he? He's got an English accent and he's on American television. I wanted to know who he was. Never heard of him. He's not certainly not known over here, that's for sure. So I looked him up. And I was really quite pleasantly surprised initially in his Wikipedia entry. Because he got a lot of abuse from certain quarters maybe 10 years ago because his views were pro-life, pro-family. I thought, this is incredible. You've got somebody who's pro-life and pro-family appearing on MSN, CBS, primetime. This is good, right? Well, not so fast. I read on a little bit further, and he very publicly denounced his earlier views, especially his pro-life views, saying that they did not represent his views now. They were immature. You get the picture. Shortly afterwards, he's handed his gig presenting this show. Draw your own conclusions. You see, Hollywood and the MSN, mainstream media, have never really forgiven Mel Gibson. Mel Gibson for The Passion of the Christ, and therefore indirectly, Jim Caviezel. That movie made so much money. Against the odds, for all the reasons that we're talking about Sound of Freedom, they can't forgive him for that. But old Mel is getting into the fight. Obviously, him and Jim Caviezel must be still good friends. I can't imagine them not being good friends. And Mel Gibson is one of the very few, he was one of the first, but he's also one of the very few Hollywood A-listers to put his head above the parapet and suggest, you may wish to see the movie Sound of Freedom. Take a listen to this.
One of the most disturbing problems in our world today is human trafficking, and particularly the trafficking of children. Now, the first step in eradicating this crime is awareness. Go see Sound of Freedom.
There you go, Mr. Mel Gibson. Hollywood A-lister, if ever there was one, telling you to go see it. Now, you would think that a Hollywood A-lister like Gibson telling you to go see a film which is all about saving children from slavery, sexual exploitation, trafficking, and all the rest, what's the problem, you would say? And I'm still slightly bemused. What is the problem here? You think that at the very least a movie like Sound of Freedom would get some respect from Hollywood, you know? A place that prides itself on its values, if not its morals. But not a bit of it. Remember, this is the movie that Disney tried to bury. They tried to bury it alive with a stake through its heart, shelving it in the cold storage room. Never to be entered, never to be opened, never to be exhibited. But as we know, angels came and witnessed its resurrection in the form of the Angel Studios, who must be laughing all the way to the proverbial bank. There's probably another reason why Sound of Freedom has attracted such fury increasingly from the mainstream media. I'm going to play you another clip from another celebrity fan who has just seen it. You know who he is. Take a listen.
Thank you all very much. That was incredible. Jim, that was unbelievable. What a job. Woo! So, I present a possibility. Yeah. And then you made this the hottest movie anywhere in the world, so I think maybe becoming the president of Mexico. By comparison, right? So I just wanted to thank you all. That was unbelievable acting. And Tim, what a job you did.
Yeah.
Great combination. Beautiful combination.
That was President Donald Trump, and he was meeting Jim Caviezel and the producers and directors of the movie as well. What he's referencing there is the producer, Edward Varastegui, is talking about political ambitions to run as president of Mexico. Whether Eduardo is daft enough to do that, I have no idea, but that's what President Trump was talking about there. But if you have an endorsement from the, President Trump, you can imagine how the mainstream media are not going to be very happy. And to be honest, it adds fuel to the fire in their imaginations as to what this movie is about. But here's the thing. Here's the thing. There's an old saying in Hollywood, in the movie world in general, in the media in general, there's no such thing as bad publicity. A movie can stand anything except to be ignored. So I'm beginning to wonder if this is backfiring on the very people who are attempting to kill off the success of Sound of Freedom. Remember their criticism. There's sniping, there's snide comments, there's sneering, is all directed at an audience to prevent them from going to see it. But it appears to be having the opposite effect, as we talked about yesterday. Just at the weekend, the movie jumped $25 million ahead in its race for box office glory. Up until last weekend, it had only achieved $100 million. I say only, but that's great. But an extra 25% of its profits is great. It's a great figure. Is this all backfiring, I asked myself. And then I thought about another old adage. One we have talked about on this show many times, and no doubt we'll talk about again. You see, we Christians, we Catholics, believe that we are not in a neutral space. We talked about this last week with some of our guests, you remember, about the spiritual battle that is taking place every single day in all sorts of ways. And we shouldn't be surprised that Hollywood is one of those front lines. Why? Well, Hollywood informs our imagination. It's the dreaming capital of the universe. If the devil can get you to dream the wrong dreams with the wrong values, he's happy, right? But there's an old saying, I know a very old saying, but I think it's true, that the devil tends to overplay his hand. Ever heard that? And you know what? I think in regard to Sound of Freedom, he is overplaying his hand big time. And it's having the opposite effect. If I were advising you, old Nick, I would say, maybe time to keep your mouth shut. Now, do you remember the question I posed at the start? Why is this all happening in July? Two reasons, maybe. One, Sound of Freedom. July in the United States is a month of freedom. The 4th of July is all about independence, about freedom from tyranny. Tyranny of the British Empire. But we Catholics also know it's the month of the precious blood. Maybe the answer as to why this is all happening in July is staring us in the face in the Holy Scriptures. In the first letter to Peter, in fact. For in there it says the following. If you know that you were ransomed, i.e. saved from slavery, from the futile ways inherited from your father, not with perishable things, such as silver or gold, but with the precious blood of Christ, like that of a lamb without blemish or spot. Yeah, that's what it's all about, folks, being ransomed. When we come back, we're going to be talking more slavery with Dr. Paul Kengar. Stay tuned to the Telly Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Video. Welcome back to Turley Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. It is so good to have your company on this Tuesday morning. Now, I believe we're having a little bit of difficulty getting connected with our guest, so we will return to Dr. Paul Kengar once he is available. And if you're listening, Dr. Paul, we're ready for you anytime you are. Now, I was talking about the precious blood just a moment ago, and I had a very strange experience just the other day. I woke up very, very early in the morning, you know, when you wake up at about 3:15 a.m. It's a terrible time to wake up because it's still the middle of the night, right? It's far too early to be getting up and doing anything. And so I just lay there and I thought, well, I'll just lie here and wait for sleep to come. And it didn't come, so I decided to listen to a podcast. It was very, very interesting. I might talk to you about that another time. And I listened to that thinking, well, this will put me to sleep. It didn't put me to sleep at all. So I was suddenly very, very awake. And I thought, well, what am I going to do? So I thought, well, I'll get up and do some work. So I did. And I was researching the topic we were discussing just a moment ago, precious blood, the month of the precious blood. And something really struck me as odd. There are two cathedrals here in London. There's one on the north bank of the Thames, which is the Westminster Diocese, and there's one on the south bank, which is Southwark Diocese. And Southwark Diocese is got a cathedral as well. And if you ever visit London and you go into it, it's the lesser known of it. It's St. George's Cathedral. Now, interestingly enough, the cathedral on the northern bank is dedicated to the precious blood, and we've talked a little bit about that in the past. But the southern one is St. George's, and I remember walking into it one day, and to the left as you go in, you will see a very nice framed photograph of a nun. Now, that's not unusual in churches. You know, you'll often see photographs of, or sorry, you'll see more statues, but occasionally you'll see photographs. But this one was sort of strange. I mean, it was obviously something from the Victorian era by the look of it. And I went over and looked at it. And the woman in the photograph, the nun, was the Venerable Mary Potter. Mary Potter. It's such an English name. It struck me, first of all. And yet she was dressed in as a religious, etc., very much as a religious. So I remember sort of glancing at the biography, which was in very small type beside the photograph. And you know what it's like when you're going into a church. You're not really in the mood to stand there reading things. You know, you want to go and pray in front of the Blessed Sacrament, or you're going to Mass, or whatever it is you're doing. So I think I glanced at it. I did notice there was some connection with London. That was about it. And then I left, or went to wherever I was heading at the time. And I thought nothing more about it, but I remember sort of making a mental note that I should check out the Venerable Mary Potter, find out who she was, when she lived, where she lived, and why there's a photograph of her at the back of a London cathedral.
Kevin, sorry to interrupt you, but we have Dr. Kengar on the phone now.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, so we'll just pause our story there about the Venerable Mary Potter. We may come back to her. She's linked to the precious blood, which is why I'm telling this story. So now my next guest is Dr. Paul Kengar, who is Professor of Political Science at Grove City College, Director of the Institute for Faith and Freedom, and Editor of the American Spectator. He often appears as a pundit on talk shows, both TV and radio, from Fox News to MSNBC to C-SPAN to Relevant Radio. He is the best-selling author of over 20 books, including A Pope and a President and The Devil and Karl Marx. Now, his latest book is entitled The Worst of Indignities, and is going to be even more controversial for this author than usual. And that's because it deals with the subject of slavery, and in particular, the subject of slavery and the Catholic Church. And its author joins me down the line this morning. Paul, welcome to the Turley Frequency. Paul, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Welcome to the Turley Frequency. So good to have you with us. Worst of indignities... The Worst of Indignities, the Catholic Church on Slavery. Now, that's quite a title at quite a time. Why did you write this book?
Well, the quote, first of all, the phrase is from Pope Pius X, and he referred to slavery as the worst of indignities, and he also referred to it as an instrument of Satan. And that's a phrase that goes back to, in papal teachings, back to the year 1537, so we're talking like almost 500 years ago, when Pope Paul III issued a bull called Sublimus Deus, and he also called slavery an instrument of Satan. And in fact, he called for excommunication of anybody in the Catholic Church, and he mentioned even princes and kings at all levels, whoever it was, that owned slaves or trafficked in slavery. And in fact, the Church had a history throughout the 1500s, way back then, of talking about excommunication and even reparations paid to slaves if they had been owned by Catholics. So, and to get to your question of why I wrote this, I did an article for Crisis Magazine about 3 or 4 years ago on called The Catholic Church, the First Abolitionists. And it just had to do with all the stuff that was going on in the summer of 2020, Black Lives Matter, all the you know, uprising in the streets over the George Floyd shooting and everything else. And I just knew enough as a Catholic historian to know that the Catholic Church had this amazing record in opposing slavery. In fact, let me go back 100 years more. 1434 and 1435. So this was around December 1434, January 1435. Pope Eugene IV issued an encyclical called Sicut Dudum, and that was called Against the Enslavement of Black Slaves in the Canary Islands. Mm-hmm. So that's, what, 57 years before Columbus even came to America? And so, yeah, this is an amazing history. And I know I'm giving you a long answer to your first question, but you can go back to the Council of Ogden, the year 506, the Church.
Well, I'm just going to pause you there, Dr. Paul, because going to lose us very quickly. And what you're saying is really important, because I have sat in lectures where very learned professors have just more or less said the opposite to what you said, that the Church had a shameful record. I mean, basically,
totally
they have imbibed a lot of other sources, secular sources, which basically said that there is nothing good in Christianity as part of a colonial effort, and that's what it was all about. So just to set the record straight for anybody listening, and I know this is really difficult, especially for a historian, I know it's torture, but could you give us the kind of thumbnail sketch of 2,000 years, just the brief headlines, so that people know that where the Church was from its very inception up until today, what the general thinking has been, and some of those highlights. Now, you've highlighted some of them already, but could you do that for us?
Yeah, well, the Church has always opposed slavery, and you're right. I mean, you could find online and even by historians and journals claims that the Church didn't get around to condemning slavery until Pope Leo XIII, right, like in the 1890s. And I've even found some where they claim Vatican II, right? But the historical ignorance is astonishing. It's astonishing. So I don't know how far you want to go back, but Council of Ogden,
well,
506.
Let's start with the early Christians, because Christianity grew up in a time when there was slavery. Slavery in the Roman Empire was very common for people to have slaves. St. Paul wrote a letter which involved an issue around a slave. So just give us the kind of initial church fathers, the apostolic era. What was the thinking around slavery at that time?
Well, I mean, you can read it if you go to the apostolic era, right? I mean, you can read it in the New Testament, statements from Paul and Galatians and others about there's neither Jew or Greek, male or female, right? Slave or non-slave. And so, I mean, you can see it there. You could see it in Onesimus, which is spelled O-N-E-S-I-M-U-S. Who's a slave that was in the New Testament. You can go to, I could tell by your accent, maybe this is getting close to home for you, St. Patrick. St. Patrick, ladies and gentlemen, was a slave. And by the way, we're looking at geography here, right? The first slaves that we're talking about initially, at least in some of these cases, are from Europe. And when does slavery start? Historians estimate that it started about 6,000 to 8,000 years ago. Some say 9,000 to 11,000 years ago. And they trace it to ancient Mesopotamia, the Tigris and Euphrates River. If you follow that, that's modern day Iraq. And also, according to the book of Genesis, it's the Garden of Eden. It's where the Garden of Eden took place. And look at your Old Testament. Jews were enslaved throughout it by the Egyptians, by Nebuchadnezzar, by the Neo-Babylonian king. So I mean, it has applied to all people and all cultures forever. I mentioned St. Patrick around the year 400. St. Gregory the Great, late 500s, was a pope, became a saint, and had been a slave. He had been a slave. So the Council of Worms.
And I think, Dr. Paul, I'm right in saying as well that it was Gregory who observed the English slaves in the Roman market and said,
right,
not angels,
right,
but angels. And that sparked his missionary efforts to convert the Anglo-Saxons in England.
Well, that's exactly right. And boy, there's just so many different chunks of history you could go to. The Chinese owning slaves, the biggest slavers in the history of humanity have been Muslims. And you know, that's been going on from the time of Muhammad, who owned slaves. You're going back about 1,400 years. And even
why
today...
Why is that, Dr. Paul? Is there something inherently lax within Islamic theology that allows for this or even propagates it?
Well, the Quran allows it, and the Quran supports it, and right. Muhammad had slaves. He was a warrior. He captured slaves. He had concubines. He had multiple wives, and I quote in the book one of the sultans just being kind of amazed at Westerners and the Pope for opposing slavery. He's just confounded by this. He said, but I don't understand. I mean, this is just what you do. You go to war, you take, you know, you kill whoever, you take the women and the others as slaves. You take boys and you make them into janissaries. You make them fight for Islam. I don't get this. I don't understand this. I don't understand what's going on. Which is why really the last countries to abolish slavery have all been Muslim countries. And right now there's something called the Islamic State, ISIS, which right now has slavery. And not just slavery of young females, young girls, but they're collecting their own janissaries nowadays. I mean, they're taking young boys, putting them into the military. So it's thriving there. It people could go to their computer right now and go to Google and type in U.S. State Department report, slavery in the Sudan or slavery in West Africa, and see that it's going on right now in the 21st century, where you have black Muslim slavers in Sudan capturing black Christians. So it's still going on. The transatlantic. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, in terms of the historical sweep, I mean, is there a direct correlation between the ending of slavery within Europe, within the Roman Empire, and the rise of Christendom, the official acceptance, embrace of Christianity by what was left of the Roman Empire?
Oh, sure. And really, the only moral force that comes forward in history to say, hey, this is wrong, are Western Christians. First led by the church, this is what everybody forgets, is why I had to write the book, going back to the 1400s. And in fact, do the math on this, it's interesting, 1434, 1435, the first church encyclicals speaking out against black slavery. And that, by the way, the transatlantic slave trade started in 1444. So that's even before black African slaves started. The church was a decade ahead of that. And then it's 400 years later that the Brits abolished slavery, Wilberforce, America about 30 years after that with the Civil War, and only then countries like Brazil got around to abolishing it in 1888. And of the millions and millions of black Africans that were sold into slavery, for starting back in 1444, less than 5% came to North America. The country that had the most was Brazil. And if we're doing this whole, you know, racial skin identification thing, right, the Brazilians aren't white folks from Ireland, all right? Every culture has engaged in this. And I'll give you one other date that'll really flip people out. We all talk about the 1619 Project in America, which the New York Times and others want to date as like the founding of America when the first black slaves came. Read the book White Cargo, which did really well, and two mainstream historians, they talk about the year 1618. Accidentally, this is just happened to be about a decade before the 1619 Project. 1618 is when the first slaves came to America. They were white indentured servants from Britain, from England. And many of them were auctioned and sold and whipped and owned. And even after another group, this doesn't get talked about during Indigenous Peoples Day, American Indians, including all five of the civilized tribes, they were called the civilized tribes, all had black African slaves. And even after the Civil War ended, some of these Indian tribes were still owning the slaves. Some of these tribes fought with the Confederacy. And to this day, there are black Americans with lawsuits against the Indian tribes trying to get reparations because of what the Indian tribes savagely did to black Africans in America who were slaves. So this is a much deeper, richer, wider story than and more evil than I think people in America realize. Yeah.
You're listening to the voice of Dr. Paul Kengor, who is very much in danger of letting facts dispute the mythologies which dominate our public discourse at the moment. When we come back, we will be continuing this discussion with with Dr. Paul Kengor about slavery in the Catholic Church, which so far has proved very illuminating. If you have any questions for Dr. Paul, feel free to call in on 888-928-0881 or text me on 251-928-2111. We'll be straight back after these words. Back to Charlie Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. I'm in discussion with the academic and author Paul Kengor, and we are discussing what may be a surprising subject for many of you, which is slavery and the Catholic Church. Certainly what Dr. Paul's been talking about so far has been news to me. Dr. Paul, I mean, when you provide people with facts as opposed to fantasies, what's the sort of reaction you're getting, not just from Catholics, but from the wider world?
Well, a lot of them, I suppose, this book just came out, but a lot of them will probably get angry because it doesn't fit the narrative of what they want to talk about. And in fact, I quote a lot in the book Thomas Sowell, who's been at Stanford, the Hoover Institution, for about 50 years. And he's a black American author. He's a conservative. And he studied slavery a lot. And among the other things he says is, and in fact, there were black groups in America in the 1990s who said this too. When they found out that slavery was going on in the Sudan and in different parts of Western Africa, and they couldn't get the Congressional Black Caucus to pay attention to it, they were outraged because they said, look, we could complain about what happened in America in the 1860s, and we should, but you know, this is going on elsewhere in the world. Why don't you guys want to talk about this? And in a lot of cases, they think it's because a lot of the people are kind of, you know, not to be political, but the ideological left want this to frame America as this sort of misbegotten evil place where slavery is America's original sin. And, you know, in some sense, you could say it is our original sin, but really it's also an unoriginal sin in America, and because it happened everywhere else. And what Sowell points out is what makes America unique is not that we had slavery, because all cultures did, but that we abolished it through the bloodiest, civil, bloodiest war in the history of our country. We lost over 600,000 boys in the Civil War, and some people think it's now 700,000. By the way, it's out of a population of about 30 million. That's more than all the combined deaths in all of American history of all boys who served in military combat. World War One, World War Two, Korea, Vietnam, all combined. And these are basically, you know, white American boys killing white American boys, and in the case of the Union, in order to end slavery. So yeah, what America did, and that whole abolitionist movement, spearheaded largely by, you know, by white Protestant Christians. And I spent a lot That's of time right. on this too. All of the founders, the Thomas West University of Dallas professor points this out, all of the founders, all of them thought that slavery was wrong. They knew it was morally wrong. Now, some of them, like Ben Franklin, John Adams, never owned slaves. Franklin headed his last public gig was the head of the Pennsylvania Society for the Abolition of Slavery. But there were others like Jefferson and Washington who had slaves. But they knew it was wrong. They said it repeatedly. They told people they wanted to end it. And in the case of Jefferson, even did all kinds of sponsoring of legislation to try to end it. So why didn't they end it in 1776? Because they couldn't. They couldn't do it then because they would have lost the entire South in the Declaration of Independence. So yeah, as Lincoln put it in the Gettysburg Address, 1863, 47 years ago, that would have been 1776, our forefathers put forth the proposition that all men are created equal. So they set in place the principles, the idea, the philosophy to set all Americans free, including black American slaves. But it would take some time to make it happen, including yes. the bloodiest war in the history of America. So we went through a hell to pay for this and to get it right. That should be commended.
Well, you're a historian, Dr. Paul, you deal with facts. I mean, I've heard there's been a sort of a counter argument to that the American Civil War was not really about slavery. It was about the Union and about different relationships between the federal government and the Union, the different states, and that this was just something that happened and was happening anyway in the South. I mean, what would be your reaction when you've studied this subject in depth? What's your reaction to that kind of counter argument?
Yeah, well, I hate to use the word states' rights because it's been so misunderstood and misconstrued by some ideologues today. Because we do have states' rights under the 10th Amendment of the Constitution. It's like one line that says the power is not reserved to the federal government exclusively or reserved to the states. So we do have states' rights. We have federalism in America. But the southern states were appealing to those states' rights in order to try to claim the right to own slaves. And for the larger country, including the Union, we said, well, states' rights are to be respected, but there's a limit to them when they're trying to deny something that violates natural law and biblical law, right? Or that violates natural law, such as the owning of slaves. So that was where that ended. So slavery, the Civil War was about those rights and whether or not states had those rights. But above all, it was over slavery. I mean, that was the deciding issue.
Got a couple of questions for you here, Dr. Paul, from our audience. Does the church have a position on what is happening in Sudan?
Oh, yeah. In fact, continuing this about 1,500 years of church statements against slavery, going back to the year 506, probably no pope has spoken out more against slavery in modern day than Pope Francis. It's in Laudato Si, Fratelli Tutti, and a number of speeches that he's given. He's spoken so many times on human trafficking. Has he mentioned Sudan? Actually, that's a good question. I could tell you that Benedict XVI did, that John Paul II did, and they did because, and I have a full chapter on her, the wonderful, amazing St. Josephine Bakita had been a Sudanese slave. And it was, in her case, she was captured by Muslim slavers once again, and her freedom only came when an Italian merchant came into the area, felt bad for her, met her, bought her, brought her back to Italy, and she was freed in Italy. And that included through the intervention of a group of sisters, a convent, a bishop, a cardinal, and others who saw to it that she was freed.
Now, you mentioned something there, which, I mean, the word traffic and trafficking is kind of very current. It's just another word, really, for slavery, essentially. You're probably also familiar at the moment with the film The Sound of Freedom, which we've just been talking about on the show this week, and its great success at the box office and also highlighting a problem. But what's really interesting is the reaction to that, a bit like some of the reactions, no doubt, to some of your arguments, historical arguments, which is to attack the people that are actually making these arguments. And do you think that there's a kind of hypocrisy in society today about what constitutes slavery? Is there a hierarchy of slaving and slavers?
Yeah, in fact, it's interesting because there are a number of organizations out there. Free the Slaves is the actual name of an organization, a number of others, and they claim that there are now more slaves in the world than at any point in the history of the world. And some numbers go from like 26 million to 40 million. And they push that, and again, not to get ideological, but a lot of these organizations are on the liberal side, and they'll run into fellow liberals on the race issue who don't want to acknowledge that because they want to be able to again say, well, not compared to what happened in America, right? And they want to be able to make it sound like we were worse, right?
It definitely doesn't. It just reminded me of somebody. I was listening to another talk radio show here in the UK, and there was somebody coming out with the usual platitudes that society has progressed, inverted commas, it has grown, we are in a much better way than we were 100 years ago, 200 years ago. And the secular interviewer just said, really? What about slavery today? And quoted just more or less what you were saying and completely blew that one away. So there is a kind of myth that somehow we are a much kinder, gentler, friendlier, warmer, rainbow-colored society than ever. But it's actually, when you drill down, a much more dangerous, violent, and enslaving world than it was 100 years ago.
Yeah, and in a way, we shouldn't have excuses today, right? I mean, we have policing that we didn't have, international policing that didn't exist 500, 600 years ago. We have, everybody has a phone that they can walk around, take pictures, video with. I mean, you could understand in a sense how they got away with slavery in the 1500s. But today in our great civilized enlightened society and Western world and internationally with the UN and the Hague and the ICJ and everything else, how is this possibly happening? So in a way you could actually argue that it's worse today. Some of that slavery today too. So yeah, we're talking about sex trafficking and human trafficking, but there are forms of sort of chattel slavery that are still going on today. So it's not as dominant as the kind of slave ships that were coming in to Spain in the 1500s, in early 1600s, packing human beings in there like rotting sardines that the amazing St. Peter Claver, who is the illustration on the cover of the book, ran to, had an oarsman row out to, and went onto the ship in the guts of the ship where even these hardened sailors wouldn't go down in there because the stench was so bad. And this Jesuit priest goes in and wipes the mucus off the faces of the slaves and uses his cloak and kisses them, kisses their faces, their ulcered faces. So yeah, that kind of thing isn't going on like it used to. And by the way, I should add here too, 400 or 500 years before Peter Claver in the 11th century, the 12th century, there was John de Matha, a priest. There was Peter Nolasco. They were starting entire religious orders that were all about and dedicated to the ransoming of slaves. So we'll hear today that, Georgetown University in the 1800s, they owned a group of slaves and they sold them. And that's true. And the president of Georgetown today has apologized for that. And it's good that he has. And that was wrong. But 800 years before that, there were orders founded by people like St. John de Matha, strictly created in order to abolish slavery.
Dr. Paul Kangor is the voice you're listening to. Dr. Paul, unfortunately, you know, we have run out of time. We've barely started to get to this. And I had one last question from the audience was, how do we resolve slavery? But I don't think in 30 seconds even you could answer that one. So you'll have to come back another day. Tell people where they can find more about you and also pick up a copy of your latest book.
Well, thanks so much. You've been a great interviewer. But just go to Amazon.com or Tan Books and type in The Worst of Indignities, Catholic Church and Slavery.
And that is Dr. Paul Kangor, who is an expert on almost everything by the looks of things. I don't know how you do it, writing all those books, but congratulations on your latest one. Dr. Paul, we'll be praying for you in the Divine Mercy Chaplet. We're just about to say it in the next segment. Is there any particular intentions you would like us to pray for today?
Well, thank you very much. Please pray for that this will be accepted and that people will open their hearts to this message and to the factual reality.
Okay, we'll do that. When we come back, we'll be praying the Divine Mercy Chaplet. Stay tuned to the Turley Frequency.